Hello and welcome to the Hulkcast, a newly minted Premier League podcast. I'm James Rushton, once again joined by Danny Raza. Aston Villa have just beat Derby County in the playoff final at Wembley Stadium. And yeah, we're a Premier League team, Danny.
We are. I can't believe it, man. We've all been waiting for years. And, you know, it was just such a sweet feeling to finally go back up to the Premier League. I feel like we as the fans have been subject to so much like pain over the last decade or so that, you know, it just sweetened the deal even more. Yeah, it felt surreal. I'll have to say it this way, right? I think it felt really weird for us to have such a good thing happen to us. And I'm still not quite over it.
It doesn't often happen that good things happen to Villa fans. It seems like the last 10 years especially, we've had a right kick in. I know there's older fans out there listening, and God bless you. But I think we hear a lot about Villa going down to the third division and stuff like that and then bouncing back up. But we've just had constant... It just seems the last 10, 15 years since Martin O'Neill... Well, not even since O'Neill left. The real kicker was when Julio left because of health problems. And it just seems like all the hard work that Lerner put in his first years... It just blew up in his face, and it blew up in our faces, and the club just went completely downhill. And it never really stopped going downhill until this year.
No, I know. It's ridiculous. And even for much of this season, it was going downhill. Even once Dean Smith was in charge for a certain amount of time, we were still, you know, around about mid-table. And it would have left us finishing, you know, below where we did last season. And yeah, it's just crazy to think that we're finally up. I mean, James, you experienced the atmosphere firsthand. I mean, me and you over here, we're approaching it from totally different angles. I mean, I watched it in the comfort of my bed, the playoff final. You were there. You experienced that feeling sort of full on, didn't you, so to speak?
Yeah. So I wasn't drinking or smoking any or injecting anything on the day. I was very high, and it was a natural high. I couldn't walk straight. I was just completely, enslaved to the atmosphere after. And it's a good feeling. It was just intoxicating. It was just, you know, filling your veins. And the whole match was just I don't know how to describe it, because the first 20 or 30 minutes were just, it's the same again. There's reversing a team that is decked out in black and white. Half the stadium's roaring them on. They're playing good football. Everyone wants them to win because Frank Lampard's the manager. And you think, it's happening again. It's happening again, isn't it? It's going to happen again. Mm. It's all the same. But it's not, because Anwar El Ghazi gets on the end of a cross. He buries it just before half time. And you're thinking, right, it's done now. That goal. I know a lot is made about the scoreline 2-1 and John McGinn's goal. Villa scored first. They won. That goal, for as good as, you know, regardless of the scoreline, that is the one that put Villa in. Because I didn't, honestly, no doubt in my mind. Honest to God. I thought, Derby, it's not their day. When they get the amount of chances they had and don't take them, it's not their day. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it felt like that, didn't it? I think. I mean,
It's all well and good me saying I didn't think that we'd lose it. But due to the amount of extra time we had at the end of 7 minutes, man, I thought it was three. I swore he said three. I was like, it's only 3 minutes. It just kept going on and on. I was like, where's it going to end? I thought, that's it now.
I was a bit nervous. Was it not tense once Derby scored? I mean, it was quite late on, and Derby scored the sweet spot, didn't they? I think, you know, around about the 80th minute is sort of like the sweet spot, isn't it? Because that's when a team kind of almost has to start defending and can't sort of, you know, contest the game on an equal playing field, right?
Well, yeah, it's all well and good me sitting here and saying, you know, it was we handled them, and we did, but at the time, you know, when we're creeping on in injury time and they've just scored. It did feel, it was nervous. It was absolutely nervous. But you look back at the highlights and you're thinking, Phil, this was never out of Villa's hands. Ever. The way they defended was exceptional.
So I don't know if you're inviting me to come in and analyse straight away here, James.
Absolutely. But absolutely.
I thought Derby, I've been saying this. I mean, I've been speaking to people at work today. a lot of people asking me if I was at the game yesterday. I was not, but I was happy nonetheless. But yeah, I think a lot of fans, a lot of Championship fans, have spoken to today. I mean, agreeing with me on this point. I think Derby played like we did last year. I think the occasion got the better of them. I mean, their defending was woeful. Frank Lampard, whilst I think he's done a tremendous job at Derby this season, I thought he made the wrong team selection. I think that Jack Marriott would have done us 10 times more damage, or would have scared us 10 times more than Mason Bennett did up front. And you could see it in the change of emphasis sort of late on once Derby decided, right, no, we've got to attack. They seemed to set up to frustrate us, and it bit them. And just like I said last season, just like we said last season, just like many of us have said, following Steve Bruce's sort of performance in the playoffs last season, you can't approach the playoff final like that. You have to be on the front foot, because it's that last game. It's, you know, if the other team turns up, then I'm sorry, but you're not frustrating them out of a victory. I have never, correct me if I'm wrong, right? And I've probably only seen a handful of playoff finals in comparison to the amount that they have had. I have never seen a team approach a playoff final to frustrate the opposition ever win that final. I've never seen that happen.
Yeah, we've definitely got recent history of that not happening. I mean, Aston Villa really didn't find their feet last season. The season before that, I believe it was... who went up? It was Huddersfield, wasn't it? And Huddersfield weren't saying that to frustrate anyone. I mean, they didn't really do a great job of scoring, because I think they went through their three matches without actually winning. It was a penalty shootouts and draws.
True, but that was David Wagner's high-pressing, you know, high-energy Huddersfield team.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not they managed to score many goals.
Yeah, no, it's just they weren't sitting out to frustrate anyone. It so happened that they didn't score. But, you know, based on recent history, the last three finals, you're looking at teams, especially from our own story of Aston Villa, sitting back or losing yourself in that moment, you're not going to do it. And I think Villa was so, they were exceptional. And the attack was good. But let me tell you, that defence was on point, because expected goals can say what it likes. It does not matter in that single match. Doesn't matter, because one team might have got the higher score and expected goals. That team is not a Premier League team.
No, definitely. I think there's an element as well of Conor McGregor style, Floyd Mayweather style visualization as well in that Villa side. I think everybody just looks so confident, and as you say, just defensively, we were just so solid. When you see Mings and Tonzibi on, you know, at centre back, you look at it and you think, right, there's just no better decision Villa could have made here. Now they are set up perfectly. No other Championship team could hope for anything better, like in that sense. And I think as well, you know, when you approach that game, sort of, and we've had it in the back of our heads. I think the players have had it in the back of their heads that we're going up. You know, Tammy Abraham, you can sense from his body language, even the penalty shootout last week, that all of these players believe that they were gonna go up. And I think there's a lot to say for visualization, and the psychology of the team just looks so much better than it did last season. And I think that that inserts itself into that defensive mentality. No cock-ups like there was last season. John Terry's more than made up for it, but. On the other side, in the opposition, Derby, they did make those kinds of errors, and you know them being the team that sort of, I don't think they ever thought they were going to win it. Basically,
yeah, I thought their belief came in two periods. It was that first 20 minutes. I thought Derby had a bit of belief that they could hold Villa and pounce, and also in the last 10. They seem to come on quite strongly. And I think Frank Lampard, being quite a novice manager, of course, he's adapted throughout the season. He's evolved. He's got better as the seasons went on. His side certainly have improved. He seems to have been a lot more realistic and pragmatic in his approach, where he was more of a dreamer, I guess, at the start. And he thought he could come in with a big idea of a football that he wanted to play. And then when it came to playing it, he didn't really have the players for it. I think he's evolved. I think he'll be a lot better next season. I'm hoping so, because they're... over the season, their numbers, they've reflected exactly what happened to Reading, which is you overachieve, you end up in the playoff final, you lose the playoff final. What happens next season is an utter collapse. And I'm really hoping that doesn't happen. I'm hoping he learns and improves and that number's just anomaly. I can't even say that, right, mate. Can you say that? Can you say that for me?
I think what James is trying to say is anomaly.
Yes, there we go. So I hope that he improves and it's just one of those and not a complete Reading situation, because it's disastrous. We have friends who are Reading fans who listen to the podcast. So we all know how terrible that was to get one kick away from the Premier League and then collapse. And I'm really hoping that doesn't, from an outside perspective now, because we don't care about the Championship anymore, mate, that Derby continue to improve and Frank Lampard continues to improve, and maybe they'll be there next year. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll go up automatically. Who knows? But I'm hoping that they do well. Should we talk about Villa stuff? Let's talk about something Villa. Let's talk about that goal.
Yeah.
That first goal.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So I'll try. Let me just remember it. I remember it now. That was Al-Mohammadi whipping it in. But before that, I think it was Conor Hourihan. Was it with the through ball? Through ball to Al-Mohammadi, if I remember correctly. And it was an attack that was started from our own area. And this was very much whilst Derby were on the attack. Derby had sort of started pushing forward throughout. And a lot of that game seemed to be, you know, especially at that point, seemed to be being played in our half. And Conor Hourihan finds Al-Mohammadi, but Al-Mohammadi with a beautiful cross. I don't know who it was that said it, but a few people were saying if Al-Mohammadi plays anything, you know, like he did in the first Albion game, we'll be in. And yeah, he's just whipping in a beautiful cross for Anwar El Ghazi, and it was almost identical to an earlier one, which sort of was ruled offside before Anwar El Ghazi could put it in the back of the net. But yeah, El Ghazi ends up ends up jumping for it. It was a diving header, wasn't it? If I remember correctly, or am I glamorizing it in my head?
No, he actually looks like he's been chucked out of a pub by a bouncer. He just flies into
it. There was that people have been putting up that picture of Lois Griffin jumping off the stairs.
Okay,
you see that? And I mean that's exactly how I remember it now. James, I mean, you were there. What, describe the noise level when that went in?
So I think it's at that time of the match when people are going, yeah, we're going to go in for drinks now, because there's not that much time in the match left in the first half for anything to really happen. So we're going to go in for a drink. They go in for a drink. They miss the goal. It pops. It goes off. Absolutely. Hugging, jumping, belief. The belief flows back in, because I think Villa, you go into the match with hope and belief. Then it kicks off and you're thinking it's happening again. It's a bloody another team. They're gonna go up because everyone else wants them to go up. Then Villa score. And it's just like you knew it was going to happen, but also you didn't expect it. You didn't think you'd see it with your own eyes, and you did. In terms of the goal, I had to wait and see it, and I'm replaying the highlights to actually notice it. All I saw was the cross get whipped in from Almo. Fantastic overload, by the way. I think Dean Smith pushed the wingers up for more of a 4-3-3 than whatever they were doing before, because you had a front line of Abraham, Adoma and El Ghazi, and it worked perfectly because you've got Adoma pushing up. He can pull it back to Almo, and because El Ghazi's so far up the pitch, he can naturally crash in and header it up. So complete tactical decision executed to perfection by a number of wide players there, and mate, it just went off. Absolutely. All I saw was the ball hit the net, and you just know there's no offside flag. It's in, it counts. Villa are 1-0 up.
Yeah, no, it was beautiful. I think Derby probably could have defended it a little bit better, but I think it was a Bogle that was marking him. I might be totally wrong here, but anyway, El Ghazi's basically, it's way too easy for him to get there. But I think the run that he made was beautiful. Actually, I think, you know, the positioning was strong, and I mean the commentator almost foreshadowed it as well, because I mean they mentioned El Ghazi's height and how, you know, he probably is quite a presence when it comes to set pieces, and I think it was really important as well that El Ghazi cuts in, because, you know, I think especially in the last few weeks or so, I know we've been in tremendous form, but especially in the last few weeks or so, I've noticed that Tammy Abraham's been getting almost less and less involved with the game. It's not a that's not a criticism of him. I definitely think he's been marked out, and I think teams know that if they can, you know, get rid of him as a focal point, Villa will sort of struggle to score. And so I think just that added support and somebody like El Ghazi being able to cut in and sort of get in there as an extra centre forward option, especially when it comes to set pieces or when it comes to crosses, it's so important, and it's really added something to Villa's game. And we've seen it come to life, especially in the last few weeks.
Let's talk about how good that cross was, though, because Almo, he's in the danger zone, right? He's on the corner of the box. He crosses it in, and I want to go into the actual set piece area of this, because it's almost like a free kick in motion, because what he does, he crosses it, it goes over the keeper, so this is pitched perfectly to be out of the reach of Roos in the Derby goal. It's beyond all the defenders, they're all facing Almo, so there's only two people who are ever going to attack this, and that's a bloke marking El Ghazi. So it is a complete battle between two players, because it's beyond the keeper, beyond all the centre backs. They're looking at that Almond, they have to adjust their position as the cross comes in. So there's only two people here who can really do anything, and that's El Ghazi and the fullback marking him. And because El Ghazi's got the beating of his fullback through pace and positioning, he's took that clean out. And I mean, as much as we praise El Ghazi for beating that man there, that's the easiest part of the job.
What, defensively?
No, the easiest part is getting past that fullback, yeah, attacking the ball. The hardest part is Almond's bit, where he has to cross in over the keeper and beyond the centre back. It was fantastic.
I've decided to pop the goal up in my view so that I can sort of so I can confirm a couple of details, right? So one of the things that I think was beneficial of having Adoma start on the right wing, don't worry, this is relevant, is that him and El Mohamedy have sort of for two seasons seemed to get along with each other really well. Whilst Adoma's been out of form and not scored as many as he should have done, him and El Mohamedy seem to work really well in synchronization. Now, Conor Hourand's obviously dinked that up to Albert Adoma, and El Mohamedy always knows where to find the right space to get across in. He always seems to find it, and he never ever seems to be sort of stretched. You always wonder without his pace, you know, whether he's going to whether he's going to struggle to whip that ball in. But as you say, you know, he's got that perfectly. I mean, that was pinpoint. That was pinpoint. And I think whilst his cross was amazing, I'm going to slightly disagree with you and say that I think the hardest part of the job there is El Ghazi. Is El Ghazi running in for that. Because whilst El Mohamedy has crossed that in, El Ghazi is actually ages away. But
Is that planned out then? Do you think that's not a moment of inspiration? That's a in-game set play?
No, because I think El Mohamedy's made a very, very educated guess here as well. I genuinely do think so, because it's not just Abraham in the box there. You have got El Ghazi in the box. And I think what El Mohamedy's done really well there, he's almost put that right in the middle of El Mohamedy. And sorry, El Mohamedy has put that right in the middle of Abraham and El Ghazi. What he needs is for one of them to get a touch to that. Preferably the guy making the forward run, and that is El Ghazi. I think to be honest, whichever way you look at it, it's just beautiful play from the two of them.
I think that, you know, we can't take it away from either of them, because Almo's put that. The way he's hit the cross and where he's pulled it, it's caught everyone looking, because they can't do anything else. What can they do? It's over and above them. There's nothing they can do except watch it as it goes on its path.
Yeah, it's also too low for the defenders to deal with that comfortably. You want to, when you're a centre half, you want to be able to head that out of the box. It's kind of too high for the first defender and too low for the second one. It just dipped perfectly. And you know, El Mohamedy almost just turns around as soon as that goal's gone in, just as if to acknowledge himself, kind of. This is what I remember. He just acknowledged that cross to himself. And I just remember sort of looking at it and thinking, yep, it's my two Muslim brothers whipping that in. Ramadan Mubarak.
Let's talk about that, mate, because it was revealed, and I don't know who to attribute the news to, but Anwar El Ghazi, he did ask for God's forgiveness after breaking his fast early, so he was in peak physical condition. Right. For the playoff final, he was in peak physical condition. because he broke his fast. He did ask for God's forgiveness. He said he will make the time up and he hopes that God forgives him. Where does this lie, mate? Can you educate the listeners? Because I can't really, can I?
Yeah, so I would say, like, I don't think anybody should assume that El Ghazi's done anything wrong here. And I know a lot of people listening aren't religious anyway, but I'd say just from a religious perspective, I mean, don't assume he's done anything wrong, because there is cases absolutely for travelers where you know they're not sort of they're not obliged to keep the fast. What he is obliged to do is to make that up. So I think he needs to make it up for it, in some way. El Ghazi, and you know, I have no doubt that he will. It is tough, isn't it? It is tough playing in a final of that sort of stature. If he has the opportunity not to fast, I can understand why he's decided not to in this case. And to be honest, look how well he performed. I'm sure he'll go back and make up for it in his own way.
Yeah, as he said, but fair play to him. I mean, it must be a big decision for him to take on it. You know, it's not just his own feelings, but whether he feels any judgment from anyone else, or whether that, you know, he may be putting that on himself, that much pressure.
Oh,
mate.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, just look at it in this way. You know, back in the old days, when people would have fasted, you know, they would have had to travel, you know, long distances, and then you're sort of playing with two different time zones, aren't you? In a sense, I mean, I remember traveling from Poland to Birmingham one day, and I didn't fast on that day because, you know, it just gets really complicated with time zones. Look, El Ghazi and El Mohammadi, they've been fasting. You know, they've been on that spiritual kick, so to speak. You know, they might not have fasted during the final, but they're participating in it, and I'm sure, you know, the Muslim community is incredibly proud of these boys.
So Villa's second goal, mate, this one is absolute chaos, and I don't think we can, glamorize it as much as the first one. The first one could really dissect and analyze, but this is just complete chaos. El Ghazi kicks the ball. He's obviously going for a shot. It takes a massive deflection. It's looping in a massive arch. And a Roos in the Derby goal, he goes for it, but he's a bit rattled by the presence of John McGinn. John McGinn, not the tallest player, not the fastest player, probably the fittest player. He beats Roos to the goal, and Roos can use his bloody hands. So he gets to the ball, kind of bounces into it, and it's a goal out of absolutely nothing. It's a non-situation. A goal should not happen there. The keeper has the right to claim that, and he doesn't even get anywhere near it. It hits McGinn and goes in.
So this is a goal that was about as aesthetically pleasing as John McGinn's FIFA avatar. And I think it was actually... what I will say about the goalkeeper, Roos, over here, is that he has gone totally against the principles of fielding in cricket. With this ball, it's one of the first things that you learn. When that ball,
it's not cricket. It's not.
Listen, James. Listen to me. All right, that ball is above him and John McGinn, isn't it? Right. Why is he trying to catch it underarm? Why is he trying to bring that ball in? You know what he should be doing at that point is, you know, making him, you know, reaching with his hands, try and get something to it. He's almost jumped up in the air and tried to catch it, sort of like imagine it sort of cradling it, basically. He's tried to cradle that ball, but you know, John McGinn's head is getting to that any day of the week if he tries to do that. I just thought it was really inexperienced goalkeeping. I think John McGinn did really well to get to it anyway. Because either way you look at that, he's dinked the ball into the back of the net. And it was still a very, very strong header from him in the end.
That keeper should be absolutely cleaning McGinn out. He shouldn't be retreating back into his own goal and trying to catch the ball like that. He has every right there to absolutely take McGinn out. No, there's no, you know, McGinn's pushing it. He's really pushing it by being that close to the keeper, because the keeper can get away with a lot. It's his box. He can get away with so much. He can just clear him out. Call for the ball. It's your ball. Put the hands up. Take it strongly. He made a massive error, and it was all for Villa's game, because that second goal won us the game, really. You know, in terms of the scoreline, he did win us the game. As much as we're going about Algarzi's one, that was more important because it was the first goal. I really thought whoever scored first would win the game. But 2-1, thanks to John McGinn, thanks to the goalkeeping error, that's the actual winner.
I think also, if you're the defender there, how are you being beaten in the air by John McGinn? No, look, I love John McGinn. He's super John McGinn, and he's an absolute terrier. His strongest point is not in the air. I just think, you know, that could have been dealt with so much better. His defenders, they're just not covering their ground. It's almost as though they've become so preoccupied with Tammy Abraham there that they've just sort of let John McGinn sort of get loose and get free there. But look, I'm not complaining. It was strong positioning from McGinn in the end, and that ball just ended up bobbling into the back of the net. Unaesthetic, maybe. But very, very important. James, at that point in the ground, again, I know we're kind of approaching this like a story almost, but at that point in the ground, what's going on in the Villa section and what's going on in the Derby section?
So don't know what happened in the Derby section, but I was on the floor.
You were on the floor?
I was on the floor. Yeah, I got completely knocked over. It was absolute pandemonium.
Oh, really?
Chaos. Because that's when that goal goes in, you know that Villa have won the match, right? You really... I mean, it's in the back of your mind that they can come back, but you are getting really confident now. Like, two goals. Come on. It's Wembley. Cup final. You know you've won it.
Right. I'm just going to give a quick shout out to my friend Sean, right? He doesn't listen to the podcast. He told me that near him, a guy got sparked out by celebrations. I'm wondering if that's you now, or do you think there was many of you?
Mate, no one's laying hands on me.
No one's laying hands on you.
My dad was hugging me. My stepbrother was hugging me. My other stepbrother was hugging me. We all fell over because there were so many bodies, mate.
Right, right.
You have to understand that people trying to nick seats and get with their friends because I was in the wrong seat. So there's a lot of packed in. There's a lot of bodies packed in. The nature of the goal, the context, it's the second goal in what amounts to a cup final at Wembley. The second goal is very important because it's put you two up. You're in a strong position. You're in a really confident position. So everyone's going absolutely crazy, but there's really loads of bodies packed in. You're not staying on your feet. Crazy, mate. Crazy. I did not get sparked out.
It was interesting as well, Villa. I mean, almost getting luck as well. Because I don't care what anyone says. It was great that we were pushing forward and we got the goals that yesterday. But I think, you know, last year if we made the same chances, they're not going in. I think it was one of them. I think it was interesting that happened because we're almost so used to it being super tense, and it never really felt incredibly tense, did it? It always felt enjoyable to watch. There was never a point in that game where it was unbearable. And I think it was just nice to see us go in there and do a professional job. And I think at 2-0 up, I think Derby are just really struggling. I mean, I think it's at this point, isn't it, that they bring on Waghorn and Marriott?
They really went for it. And I think they should have done that from the start. I thought that's a lesson they learned against Leeds. If they go direct, if they play the ball into space, if they ping it around, make fast movement in the final third, they'll win the game. And they would have done that had they played that from the front, but they didn't. And Villa ended up winning.
Well, they'd have certainly given us a game. I just think that, like, look, I mean, Jack Marriott comes on, doesn't he? And okay, I'm gonna accredit that goal to him because, I mean, Waghorn, mate, you're an absolute... You can't be stealing goals like that. It's not nice. But Marriott basically is the kind of player that scores against Villa every single time he's on the pitch against us. I'm pretty sure that happens anyway. I'm pretty sure every time Marriott scores against us, plays against us, he scores. I remember him. Was he not at Peterborough when Peterborough knocked us out?
So yeah, so he scored against us for Peterborough, but he hasn't done it for Derby because Derby only scored against us this year. In yesterday's match.
Sure. Right, okay.
Yeah, because we put three past them at Pride Park, four past them at Villa Park, and they haven't scored. So he did knock us out of the FA Cup though.
One of the things my old man was worried about was the fact that we'd beaten Derby twice already in the season. And it's just one of those ones where you just don't end up, you don't beat a team three times in a row. It's just difficult to do. But we almost seem to kind of go into that game as the strongest team and just say, look, this is us. We're stamping our authority. We're the ones who deserve to go up. And I just thought after that point, after 2-0, I just, you know, I was cruising at that point, James. I was cruising. I was lying back, just kind of thinking, whatever happens, happens now.
I'm so glad that we managed to achieve promotion yesterday. I'm so glad that we went up at Wembley. I mean, as good as it would have been to go up automatic, it's just the storyline is just perfect, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely perfect. And it go up automatic, yeah, it's great. It's so comfy. But it was so dramatic. The whole playoff campaign has just been back and forth. You're going through, you're not going through, you're not going up, you are going up, you're back and forth. Oh, it's penalties. No, we're not going through. Oh, but we are, we're going to the final. And we've got Derby. We're going through. Oh, we're not going through because everyone wants Frank Lampard to go through and all the spiritual energy or whatever's with him. And then we are going through. And then we actually are going up. It goes back and forth so much. And it's been absolutely perfect. It hasn't done wonders for my heart, I will say.
Not the season of the game.
To be honest, the last 3 weeks have been tremendously difficult on my body. Adrenaline, mate, I've not been able to process it very well at all. I've just been shaking all day from basically yesterday.
I am buying the Blu-ray of the season review this season. it's been something. James, were you at the playoff final last season?
Yes.
You were, right? I mean, for anybody who's gone to it last season and known how it's felt, I just think it's incredibly brave to go there again. I think it's really brave.
Oh, yeah.
I think a lot of people have asked me why I haven't gone. I mean, part of it is because I've been fasting and I don't fancy the trip and all that. But I think also part of me, and I will admit to it, part of me was just so afraid of the heartbreak. So afraid of that heartbreak happening again. And I can understand why going to that game would have taken a lot out of anybody emotionally and mentally.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can absolutely sympathize with you there because it's just thinking about not doing it and all that. I mean, Villa are in really good hands. So it's not like the world would have ended like it would have last year with those plums running the club. But, you know, the fact that we're in such good hands would have been the smallest consolation. Last year, you were thinking, how are they going to get out of this one now? How are they going to get out of it? How are we going to get out of the Premier League with Steve Bruce in charge, with no James Chester, no Jack Grealish, no Codger, no John Terry, no Snodgrass, no one? How are we going to do it? And we did it.
Yeah, it's true.
No, but that's full credit to, you know, Nassef Sariris, Wes Edens, Perslow, Dean Smith, John Terry, Richard O'Kelly, Neil Cutler, everyone involved with Aston Villa Football Club because they have put in a hell of a fucking shift this year, mate. I'm telling you.
Yeah, 100%. You know, they've really done a lot to sort of take over from the last bunch, so to speak. I know me and you have our disagreements on Tony's ear, but, you know, it definitely didn't look good at the start of the season. I think, you know, the football on the pitch was poor. Perhaps things would have been different if we'd hired another manager. I think, obviously, whilst we were grateful for Steve Bruce for taking us where he did last season, you know, the impending doom that happened straight after that just kind of left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. I mean, I don't know if you saw, by the way, quick throwback, just because, you know, we're Aston Villa and everything that happens to us is overly dramatic. Did you see Keith Wyness and Tony Gia interacting with each other on Twitter last night? It was really weird.
I've made a note to speak about this and I've just put embarrassing because it is embarrassing. They've got no right. It's Villa's right. Regardless of what we think about Gia or Wyness, let's cast it aside. It's history. No one cares. That was Villa's biggest achievement in years, and they're out there acting like last year didn't happen, acting like the winding up order wasn't on the door, acting like people didn't lose their jobs. They're just going at it, like just kids on the internet. And you're thinking, hang on, this is Villa's biggest achievement. And they're both making it out to be about them.
I can see why, you know, why someone might have a problem with Zia's tweets, because I think what he said in there was my promise came true, right? But other than that, James, I do like, and I think this is, I mean, we shouldn't get too into it. I think, you know, economically, we've had this discussion before. I do think that Tony Jarre's always had Villa's best interests in mind, and I do think he cares about the club, and for him to celebrate promotion, I've got no problem with that. But then Keith Wyness commenting fraud straight under it, yeah, almost kind of like you just wonder why they're still beefing, and so publicly.
There's some clearly stuff going on there, but Shark shoots back as well, don't he? Calls him, I think there's a snake emoji in there. I was just thinking, you pair, really? You just, both of them, stop. Stop or bang your heads together. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Just, you got to leave. Today is a day to celebrate the achievements of Aston Villa after you left. It's not about you. It's not about what happened. It's not about Wyness. It's not about you. It's not about Steve Bruce. It's about Dean Smith, his players, and the owners who have taken us there, regardless of what happened. And I think it was very much in bad taste how that went down.
Yeah, it was.
Because it was, what should be in the news the day after Villa's winning is how we're going to buy bloody Lionel Messi or Mbappe or something like that, something stupid. Not, here's Keith Wyness and Dr. Tony Jarre, who have nothing to do with Aston Villa anymore, going at each other.
Zaha's still got holdings, isn't he, at Villa?
I know, as far as we say that, he hasn't been mentioned at all by anyone.
No, he hasn't.
So what I wanted to speak about as well before we wrap up and do match ball stuff is Perslow's interview that he's just done. I know you won't have seen it, mate, because it was literally on Sky Sports just as we went in to record. Mm. But I caught a bit of it. And what he said was how Villa was so badly run. He never mentioned Jarre by name. But some of the things he was saying, like Steve Bruce had to run the club on his own.
Right.
Like on his own. It was him. That's it. And that there's wastage of money. You know, it was a badly run business. It's all about the football now. We've got smart people in charge. I was just thinking, what did they spend 2 years doing? Really? But we said it was just a waste of time. We may as well have started off and just went, right, Dean Smith, I know you're a manager of Warsaw, but come in and be the Villa manager. Oh, here's Jack Grealish. Make friends. There you go. We'll get promoted in 2 years. Because it just seems like we just built up such a negative patch of time.
I mean, if you want to demonstrate more of what's been popping up from the previous regime, Ross McCormack's contract goes up to 70k.
What? See, that's the thing. It's just
from 45k, right? I mean, this is what Perslow meant when he said, he was speaking to BBC Radio 4 as well today, and he said that on the recruitment side, things in particular, haven't been handled as he, I think, okay, I'll just read the, I'll read the full quote. He said, on the recruitment side in particular, things have not been handled as I think they should be in the way our fans expect. And I think, you know, that's part of it. I think really what we need is players who care about the club and care about taking us up. And I think it was, whilst I think all of us perhaps enjoyed the ambition when Zaha first came in, you know, there certainly was a few eyebrows raised about transfer fees. We don't want to be that club. You know, we don't want to be that club that just, you know, throws money at players and expects it to just kind of work. I think what we've got now is a properly run club, like an actual system, right? Perslow seems to know what he's doing. He just comes across well. Pitark as well, in the same way. He seems to know what he's doing. And I think one of the things that that I will say is that when I was worried about, I was possibly worried about not going up because the stars have just aligned with all the transfers we have made since January. I mean, Mings just worked incredibly for us. You know, other loanees, Courtney Hawes as well, worked incredibly for us. And you sort of worry that if they go, you know, the next few signings that we bring in might not work. But I think when you think about it, they know what they're doing. I think as well, Wes Edens was talking about, I'm not sure if you saw this, but he was talking about sort of Moneyball style recruiting via statistics as well, wasn't he?
Yes, so that's something Phil have invested in before, but no one really took a, you know, hold of it. It was just, we're going to buy Veretout, Idrissa Gueye, Jordan Amavi, Adama Traore, and do whatever you want with them. That's not how it works. That's absolutely not how it works. It needs to be invested. You know, the manager needs to buy into it.
Yeah, the manager's
got no choice. You do it, and then you implement that structure on the manager. They shouldn't argue with it like Sherwood did. They shouldn't argue with it and go against it like Bruce did. They need to be totally in line with it and accept that they'll be given a squad of players to use, and these will be good players.
See, Smith seems to, I think, as opposed to what we've seen in the past, Smith seems to see the positives in everybody, doesn't he? You won't have heard the post-match interview straight away, but I think he was asked about how he's managed to keep so many of the big players happy, and I think that is something which is really interesting. He does seem to be the kind of manager that puts an arm around a player and kind of, you know, focuses on their positives rather than their negatives, and he's a fair man. He's a very fair manager,
and I think that exemplifies his approach to management. He's kept all the players happy, and he's done right by him.
I mean, a striker is quite. It's very important that we sign one in the summer, isn't it? I think Mickey Quinn was talking about Daniel Sturridge today. He's not the type I want. I mean, what I want is, you know, solid a striker who's going to stay fit all season, and is guaranteed to get you goals. I don't care what anybody says. Premier League. Right, that's what you need, right? I think it's the most important thing, right? Like, I mean, Fulham, the only reason they had a chance of staying up was Mitrovic. The only reason, personally. I think that, you know, when you look at Huddersfield, whilst they, you know, they gave it their all in a lot of games, you know, Steve Meunier wasn't really delivering. And, you know, they had awful problems, you know, trying to score goals. And it's what ultimately led to their demise. We in the Premier League under Paul Lambert, under Tim Sherwood, struggled to score goals for a number of seasons. And that's what ultimately led to our demise as well, because it looked like for years, I mean, and I'm going back a little bit, it looked like for years, every game we were playing in, right, you did not feel confident that Villa were going to grab a goal. And that
you had to really rely on Benteke and Wyman pulling off a bit of magic. Usually Benteke, but that was it.
Or, you remember Benteke, right? But James, do you remember hoping? And this was genuinely our one saving grace for a while. Do you not remember just hoping that Jordan Ayew was going to pull off a 30-yard screamer every game? That looked like our only way to score for a period of time.
We just couldn't do right by just at all, could we? We just could not give them what they needed. And you had to hope that was just going to pull something out of the bag. And that is just absolutely not the situation you want to be in next season. So I'm with you here. And I think you've already brought up the perfect man. I think we need Mitrovic. Absolutely. If we're not going to be able to get Tammy or whatever, or keep the squad together, I think the first person you look at is Mitrovic.
That's a good shout. Yeah, experienced guy, experienced player as well, who, you know, perhaps, you know, isn't gonna mind as well if other players kind of get chances around him. That's the other thing.
But defenders are scared of him as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. Do you think he plays into our pretty football though?
Oh, absolutely. All he needs is the right service. He runs into the channels. He bullies defenders. He does pretty much what you'd want Christian Benteke to do, and that's just not just holding up the ball and receiving. It's running the channels, creating these deft little 1-2s, connecting with wingers, connecting with the number 10. I think you really, really, if you can't go back and buy peak Christian Benteke at Aston Villa, you absolutely want Mitrovic. You absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, you don't go for Benteke anymore, do you?
I think probably the wrong moves, injuries, just pure bad luck. I hope that his career ain't over. I think it's really too early to say, but he's not had a bad good few years.
No, he hasn't. He hasn't at all. I like Tammy Abraham's going to be a rough one. I know we'll have money, will have the money to spend. And, you know, if we can afford him, you know, he's definitely an option. I personally can't see Chelsea letting him leave for anything less than 25 to 30 million.
I think after the season he's had, I'd be rather upset as a neutral if Chelsea didn't give him a chance just to see what he can do.
But like, whilst he's been strong in the championship, though, he does look a bit raw. Like, I can still understand why Chelsea don't want him starting up front. I mean, when he's marked out of the game, Abraham, you have to say that he does get very frustrated and, you know, doesn't seem to be able to. I can't see him sort of displacing somebody like Giroud, who is consistently sort of hustling and bustling and is just unsort of interested by defenders even sort of trying to mark him.
It's a tough question. I think again, it's like Transabay. I really want Villa to keep him, but they absolutely deserve a chance at their parent club. I really think that, truly with all my heart. I'm not saying that Tammy Abraham goes in and starts as Chelsea's new number 9 and bangs in 30 goals in the Premier League. I'm just saying there has to be a role in that matchday squad, whether it's on the subs bench, because you've done the job that you came down to do.
Oh, look, Tanzibi does as well a job as any of those Manchester United defenders. In my
opinion. 21. I was so surprised that he was 21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very young.
I think my opinion of him now has just trebled. Like, I've read that I knew he was 21, but it never really sank in right. I saw Axel Tuanzebe, 21, heading back to Manchester United, might be in line for a start under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's younger revolution. And I'm thinking, that guy is so good for a centre-back at 21. The sky is the limit. And I'm thinking, if there's a person that Villa need to go absolutely hell to leather to sign, that's the guy.
I think that's the only thing I'm worried about with our transfer kitty. It's like, a lot of that money might... I mean, when you strip back the loanies, our squad is bare, man.
That's incredibly worrying, yeah.
We've got a very, very tough job coming up. I think personally what we should try and do is maybe try and grab Tuanzebe back on loan.
Well, that was hinted at, wasn't it, actually? I think it may have been before Solskjaer came back in or before this new kind of transfer policy was handed out to him. But it was hinted that regardless of what league they'd be in, that we'd receive him on loan, even if we stayed in the Championship.
I think it would be good.
There'd be at least one more year. And I think, yes, please. Like, yeah. I would, hand on heart, take that in a second. Another loan. I don't care about the loan policy. If those loan players are good and we're in the Premier League, I'm taking them, because Tuanzebe is the real deal.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think you try and get Mings, because he seems a bit more affordable. I think you snap up El Ghazi.
In a second. Heartbeat.
Yeah, that's got to be done. But Tuanzebe, I just think that... I think if we can't sign him, it's because United have realised his value. And the only thing that's stopping him getting into that United side right now is that United are scared, I think. I think they're very scared to play sort of young players in defence like that, especially when, you know, the fans are so on them at the moment. You know, I remember watching Twitter during the Legends game that United had on the other day, and people saying stuff like, you know what's scary? You know, these guys are... these guys are better than what we've got right now. Shut up, right? Gary Neville's getting skinned if he plays in the Premier League today. I think it's a tough one for a young player like Tuanzebe. But look, he's dealt with the pressure at Villa, hasn't he? And we've been through some torrid times. And he's always seemed to be pretty solid throughout that. I think that's the one thing that he has going for him.
Yeah, well, let's finish the podcast, actually. I'm saving a lot of topics for next week when we do a season review or something like that, when we wrap up.
Yeah, we will have to save some stuff.
Catch up with our match balls. So the thing I want to speak about is a centre-back. It's James Chester. I don't know if you saw the news about him, but it came out in an interview today that he's actually, I think the exact quote was, indefinitely damaged his body thanks to playing through injury for Villa throughout this season. And it's something he'll have to now manage for the rest of his career. And at 30 years of age, I mean, look, it's not the end of the world. It's football, but that's his job. That He's now affected by doom because he's put his body on the line for Aston Villa in a situation he should have never been in.
Mm. And, you know, this goes back again, doesn't it, to really awful management. Really, really awful management. Starting the season with two centre-backs. And, you know, Chester played... I seem to remember thinking that he played every single game the season before. Or there
and
there
the one before as well.
Yep.
So and, two yeah. whole seasons and this one until he got a red card.
Right, that was it, yeah. It's just, it's not fair on him. You know, this again just comes into not rotating and also just, you know, yeah, starting the season with two centre-backs, it was just an awful move. Really, really bad move. And you know, you think about, you know, what it means for the team, but also for the individuals. If you're James Chester, you're thinking, hang on a second, you're expecting me to pull my weight, you know, for the entire season. You know, for a player who's sort of 29, 30, his body's not, you know, not in the peak of his career anymore. I don't care what anybody says. And I think it's a real shame that he's had to go through that. Really is a shame because I don't think Steve Bruce or, I mean, even Dean Smith for a period of time really had a choice but to play him when we were getting hammered the way that we were because we were in an awful position.
If you recall a player, even one to the calibre of Tommy Alvik from another club just to play for your club because you have got no one else. And if you're starting a young, really young centre-back in the, if you're putting him in the matchday squad like Dominic Revan, you have got problems. And regardless of what happened, whether Villa were let down in the summer regarding transfers, and I think they were, I think they thought certain things were going to happen. And then those things fell through at the last minute when it really, really didn't look like they would. Villa were let down somehow. And that the money's paid the price, really. Because, I mean, Villa got their goal. No matter what, Villa actually got their goal this season. They got promoted. So the only person who's really paid their price, as much as Steve Bruce lost his job, is James Chester.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I mean, let's hope that he's back. I think the best thing that the club can do for him right now is, I think, keep him at the club. Prepare not to have him being our first choice centre back. Prepare to have him play and step in. You know, at vital games. He doesn't need to play every single game of the season. Look at Company at Man City, for example, and he can still be a leadership figure. And I think, you know, the club should also be looking at him sort of potentially moving into a coaching role sort of 3 years down, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line, because, you know, you can genuinely see that in him. He's a leader. And I think even having that around the club, it could be, you know, could be very strong.
Well, certainly, I think in that case, I'd go back for Scott McKenna, who was the man who was meant to come in.
I mean, funnily enough, though, with McKenna, though, I mean, McKenna's younger. But I almost just want Villa to go for Mings now. I think you're looking at that left-sided centre-back, aren't you? With
yeah.
Benner? I want Mings. I know he's a bit older, but would you?
Get both of them. Absolutely. If you can get Scott McKenna for under 15 million, I'm telling you, take that deal.
That means saying no thank you to Courtney Hawes, though, doesn't it?
Courtney Hawes is going to be pennies, mate.
Yeah, you'd hope so.
I think depth at the back is really not going to be a problem for Villa. I think, you know, it's not like stockpiling them, but I think you're going to be losing Alfick. You can probably, if you can bring in McKenna and Mings and get Tonsabay on loan, that's a dream scale scenario for me. High in the sky.
I just can't see how we're going to have the money to fill up this squad. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, we're massively rich now, mate. I think we can do what we want within reason. I don't see we're not going to be splashing, you know, hundreds of million pounds, but I think a few smart buys a season, slowly upgrading his squad, making a team is what it's all about.
I mean, but the thing is, we'll need 6 or 7. It's quite a lot. We'll need 6 or 7.
So I think the key positions for me then is left back and striker and right wing. And that's a big ask, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, and that's not even taking into consideration the centre-backs.
We've just been making our dream situation at centre-back, ignoring the rest of the team, which needs a lot of work.
Okay, so Joe Lolley.
Yes.
Mitrovic.
So that's 10 million. That's 30 million, I reckon, you've already spent. Plus Mings, which is probably about another 15. That's 45 million. Plus Howes, let's make that 47 million. If you want
El Ghazi, let's not forget
El Ghazi. So that's 52-ish million pounds. If you want Swan Zabi as well, that's going to be put. You're really pushing it there. You're probably going to be hitting 82 million.
Right. Let's not, forget De Lansbury, be honest, and maybe move on for new midfielders. I don't know. There's still, you know, there's still the chance that that kind of thing happens as well.
Yeah, you'll probably only get a million each from though.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's 50 million.
So look, it's going to be a very, very tough ask. It's going to be a very tough ask. I'm not sure I want Glenn Whelan in the Premier League either.
That's the problem, though. You're going to have to accept the fact that Villa may be forced into additional years, not only for Glenn Whelan, but for Milay Jedinak. Which is, I know it's a massive ask, and I know that sounds stupid, but you've got to really think about the amount of players that Villa want to think about bringing in. And no one's saying Whelan's starting every match or Jedinak even sees the pitch.
Yeah.
But you really need to think about, hang on a minute, we have just replaced an entire team and now we're heading into the Premier League.
Yeah, don't throw everybody away. Don't, you know, that's the worst thing you can do.
But it's only an extra year for the pair of them. Like, that's nothing. It's a year of them just being a backup.
They won't mind, will they? I mean, that's the only thing to wonder.
They probably wouldn't, I don't think.
And then the other thing is,
they're leaders, man. They're leaders.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, I just think we're gonna have a tough summer. We really are. I think we've got it. We've got to step back a sec. Look, you know what? Listen, enjoy the playoff win. enjoy the playoff win. But you know, in a few weeks' time, what I'm saying is, we're probably gonna be talking a little bit about, you know, how difficult this is going to be. But Dean Smith said that, you know, they've been, and I think, you know, the owners as well, Perslow, the way they've been talking, they've been preparing for the, for promotion for the last, you know, for the last month or so. I'm sure they have targets in mind. I'm sure they're already doing business. I can see us doing fine. I think some of the news reports that are going around are saying 50 million. In terms of a transfer kitty for Villa, you never know whether to, you know, trust these things. That 50 million was reported by the Daily Mail. But yeah, we'll see.
You know, that 50 million transfer budget, me and you have already spent that on four players. So good luck, Dean Smith. But mate, let's wrap it up with match balls. We've got to catch up with the West Brom one. So I'm going to make an executive decision and I'm going to give all three. Two, Jed Steer.
What is this for? Is this for Albion?
Yeah, the second leg.
No, because you need to give one to Tammy, at least.
Okay, so two to Jed Steer. That's one for me, one for you in the pod, one goes to Tammy. But I'm giving you your authority back for the playoff final. Aston Villa 2, Derby County 1. Who is your match ball winner for Villa's final promotion winning game of the season?
Oh, God. This was a struggle, man. It's El Ghazi, actually. No, it's easy. It's El Ghazi. Yeah, I mean, El Ghazi's the one that came in with the header in the end. He looked like our strongest attacking threat. I thought, you know, whilst Grealish and McGinn did a fantastic job in midfield and Hourihane as well, fair play to him, it seemed as though Villa's attack just mainly was out wide. It seemed like Villa almost switched and thought, you know what, instead of going through the middle today, we're going through the wings. And El Ghazi was also the one that whipped in the cross for John McGinn. So for me, it's easy, man. It's Anwar El Ghazi.
I think Villa's three choices today are easy. My one, and I'm only saying this because I know who the other one is going to be. My choice is going to be one of the two centre-backs.
Okay.
So my choice will be, okay, so Twan Zabi was fantastic, but there was a man who put his body on the line, who went off injured, he busted gut to come back and save Villa from a certain goal. And that was Tyrone Mings.
Which moment was that where he saved us from a goal?
From my position, there was a player bursting through and he runs back and goes into a sliding tackle. And I don't know how he makes up the distance, but he completely cleans the player out, it looked like, and took the ball away when he was through on goal.
There were a lot of moments in the first half, particularly where Derby were sort of, you know.
So this was late on. Through. This was This was very late on.
Okay, sure.
Because he went straight off injured after. He was down.
Right, after it. Yeah.
And mate, this one's easy, mate. This next one. So we got Al Ghazi, Tyrone Mings. I'm putting forward John McGinn.
Okay.
Who else?
Yeah. Okay. John McGinn. Look, I mean, there's a case to be made for El Mohammadi. I thought he did a fantastic job out wide.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely a case for El Mohammadi there. I mean,
well, I'm taking McGinn, mate.
Yeah. Okay. No. I'm fair. I'm fine with McGinn because I think that we dominated the midfield, particularly for the most part of the game. And I think that, you know, him bursting forward and even attempting to score that header as well late on was great. And I think just he exemplified what he's been for us all season. He didn't even get a booking. He managed to sort that side of his game out. But yeah, he ran his heart out. And I think, you know, of the midfielders that we had on the pitch that day, I think somebody else pointed it out as well. He was probably the strongest. I think Grealish did a great job as well as captain. Don't get me wrong. I think that this was genuinely a very, very good all-round performance. I think there's probably about five or six guys here who could have got match balls. But James, you were at the game, mate. You would have seen John McGinn running around the whole pitch. If that's who you want to go for, I'm 100% with you.
Excellent. So on a final note, please go to at Yorkshire AVFC on Twitter, and please consider donating to a Just Giving after to repair a Derby fan coach, which was actually attacked by a number of idiotic Aston Villa fans, unfortunately. So that's to raise money to refund the people on the coach and to repair the coach itself.
Fantastic.
A lot of people moaning about the fundraising and the fact that the coach company might be taking people for a ride. But hey, Villa fans put themselves in that situation anyway, so it's a really good gesture. Please check that Twitter page out. That's at Yorkshire AVFC. I believe it's his pinned tweet, but they're trying to raise money to refund the fans and repair that coach, and I think that's only right. You can follow me at Gemma Rushton. Find him at Rise of Journo. It's been the Hulkcast. You can find us at 7500 to Hulk. We'll be back next week with a season review.
Hold on, James. Let's not escape, James. There's one thing you've forgotten to say to me.
What?
Is there not a congratulations in place here?
Oh, fucking hell. Okay. So as you know, we do predictions for most matches, and executive producer Trevor Hood keeps us up to date. He calculates the match balls. He's got us all set up every show. We did a predictions, and we don't revel each week because it's all about the end of the season, right? Danny Raza, of course, has won the predictions. He's got a number of matches bang on. I think it's three or four bang on.
Something like that, yeah.
Which beats my two, and I think it beats Phil's three. So you are, again, for the second season running, the predictions champion. And Danny, I reluctantly congratulate you.
No, thanks a lot. It's been a very, very close one, though. It's been very, very close.
You've got this planned out. You've got a little... You've definitely got a script.
I do not have a script.
You've definitely got a speech.
What I will say is, right, I'm claiming three victories on playoff day because, obviously, Villa won the playoffs. I'm claiming Union Berlin as my German team as well, winning their playoff. And also, I nicked this prediction league on the final game of the season. I nicked it at the playoff final. And it was between me and Phil. So now all I can say is thanks to everybody who supported me. Yeah.
Nobody supported you.
Thanks for everybody that supported me throughout the season.
Not one person supported you.
Either way.
That was really harsh. That's really harsh.
Either way, I'm taking it.
All right. Well, mate, that is just such a good way to end the show. I mean, it's better than this time last season. You can find us on Twitter. Enjoy the whole cast. We'll be back next week for a season review where I won't be punished by Danny Raza's predictions or anything like that. But we will have a few fun and games until the new season kicks off. See you soon. It's a Premier League podcast. I can't believe I'm saying that. It's a Premier League club. We're back in the big time. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.